And welcome to Sundance on the Weekend, Sunday edition. I'm Rick Bruff, and we're here for the next couple of hours talking to filmmakers, industry people, and Sundance folk about what's going on at the festival. This week, or this morning, my special co-host is Stacey Domalski. Hi, Stace.
Hey, Rick. How's it going?
Otherwise, sometimes known as Cecil B. Domalski.
Oh, stop.
The multi-talented, besides being a involved... Hello? a screenwriter, a director, stand-up comic, slash... committed community member? What, any categories?
No, that's plenty, Rick, on a Sunday morning, yeah.
And to start with, we're on with the director of All the Beautiful Things, John Harkrider. And let's see, John, you have, your film hasn't quite seen a festival audience yet. Is it it's tomorrow?
Yeah, it's the world premiere will be tomorrow at 6 p.m. Mm.
I just to start with, the most striking thing is I was just reading the summation of the film, and I had to sort of look and make sure I was in the right part of the program because it's documentary. But I thought, wait, is this a typo? Is this something from the dramatic competition that accidentally got put in here? Because the description sounds two guys meet at a bar dealing with their past. How are you doing a documentary about something that sounds like a dramatic premise here?
Well, I think life can be dramatic, and I think that what the film is about. Why don't we start there, and then sort of talk about how it built from sort of a traditional documentary to something that's perhaps, at least stylistically, more of a hybrid, but in its essence, entirely a documentary. So around 15 years ago, a girl who was a friend of mine came up to me and told me that my best friend had beaten her up and raped her, and then asked me what she should do. And I had come from a history when I was a kid of a lot of domestic violence, and I wasn't about to tell a girl who had bruises on her face and a little mark on her neck where she said the knife had been that she should, suck it up and not tell anybody. So I said, you should go to the police, which is what she did, and she pressed charges. And my best friend, who had been my best friend for 30 years, it was not like, some guy I'd been friends with, for the last, 2 weeks. He wasn't my Facebook friend, right? He was a real friend. And, we had gone through a lot in life. And he was black and I was white. And I didn't first fully anticipate what was going to happen, with the police. I didn't fully understand, that he was going to get thrown against the wall and handcuffed and put on trial where he was going to be facing 80 years to life. And I didn't realize that she was lying the whole time, which is something that came out later. He was ultimately acquitted. So, that's the story. And so the story is, why we were friends, how we were friends, how this event occurred, and how we resolved our friendship. So that's sort of the premise. That's what the story is about. And there were lots of different ways of doing this. One way is to have a traditional documentary where we would just be interviewed with a interviewer behind the camera. And I'm a stylistic filmmaker. I mean, I really love aesthetics. And that wasn't entirely pleasing to me. So I said, why can't I take the interviewer and take them from behind the camera to in front of the camera? And having put them in front of the camera, why can't they be, a bartender or a cab driver or a limo driver? All sort of typical situations where you might be engaged in long conversations with somebody. And then having made the decision that this person could be any one of those characters, why does the, you know, the room have to be, you know, a white box with, you know, someone's two people sitting there? Why can't it be, you know, a bar, and why can't it have tons of people in it? And so the reason it's a documentary is because we're not recreating anything. What we're doing is we're going to a place in real life, in real time, where we're talking to the person driving us there about sort of what's going on in our lives and why we're going there. And then we get to a bar that has lots of people in it, and has, you know, a jazz band playing. And we talk to each other and through the bartender about both how we became friends, sort of telling that story to her. And then, you know, we have a pretty big argument
now,
about that.
I have a question about that. How did you convince him? His name's Baron, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
How did you convince him to do this? I mean, it's a little bit of it's almost a little too much reality documentary. Mm-hmm. And I mean, how did that conversation go down where you first approach him and say, I have a really good idea. You know that riff we have between us that almost changed your life or did change your life? I'd like to talk about it in a public place in front of a camera and then put it up on a big screen for all the world to see. What do you think?
Right. Okay, so that's a great question. So, you know, we're both film lovers, and, you know, this isn't my first film. And we both, you know, I think it's really two different things. I think, first of all, he wanted to tell his story, right? I mean, one of the things that this woman did, which was probably my first indication that she probably wasn't telling the truth, is he's a well-known photographer. And so one of the first things that she did is she sent faxes to the New York Times, to Forbes, to Vibe, to every place that he had worked for, and he had done, you know, the cover of the magazine, and said, you know, my name is blank. I was raped by this other guy, and don't ever hire him. He's a rapist. And, you know, I'm not a woman. I've never been raped. I don't pretend to know anything about that, except for the fact that I think it's pretty highly unlikely that a woman would broadcast that. And what was actually going on was vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And because he had broken up with her and there was a bad situation there, and she, you know, she wanted to get even with him. So there were lots of rumors that got spread as a result of that. And so he wanted to sort of, you know, it wasn't enough to be acquitted. He also wanted to tell his story. And this is why this is the story of his innocence. So that was part of it. Another part of it was, you know, we both love film, and we both thought we could make something really beautiful. And we both thought that, together we could make a very beautiful document in some sense of both our friendship, our lives, and things that we cared a lot about, not just the trial, but race relations or just social justice or other things that we cared a lot about.
Mm-hmm. Is he out here this week?
Yes, he is.
So he'll be at the Q&A sessions as well?
Yes, he will be.
And this was all in Boston? No.
So we're from Boston.
Uh-huh.
We grew up in Boston. So the film takes place both in Boston and New York. And it's somewhat lyrical. We actually, in the last act, were walking back from Boston to New York through the seasons, through winter until spring.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, had to shoot in every single one of – that's actually one of the bigger challenges, was to find something that you could wear in the dead of winter and also in spring that was not going to both freeze you and make you warm. So.
Yeah. Was there ever a point when you were having this conversation together in front of the camera where you go down this path, and then all of a sudden one of you or both go, "Oh, this is getting a little harder than I thought"? Or did you come upon a point where you wanted to turn off the camera but you didn't, or did you just forget the camera was there?
Yeah, I think, and that's actually probably the way it is most a documentary, is that it was, you know, we had, you know, 100 people in this bar. We had a wonderful jazz band playing John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, which no one's ever gotten the rights to until we did. And, you know, everyone's drinking and they're smoking and it felt like we were, you know, we're at a bar. And so, you know, we didn't say, "Oh, there's a camera over there." It was just, we were having this conversation. Now, the conversation got brutal at certain points, and it was very challenging. And there were times at which I was actually concerned, especially in the beginning, I was concerned about, you know, whether the film was actually going to complete, because, I mean, we wanted to kill each other. We were both very, very angry at each other. And but the funny thing is, despite all of the sort of, you know, impetus to make the film, this sort of driving, you know, passion to make the film because we both wanted to tell our stories, once we got it out and sort of finished the film, I was like, I think we both of us were like, why did we make this film? You know,
yeah.
So the thing that you're talking about actually came out more at the end because sort of the angst was gone and because we had reached sort of a peace and a repose. And then once you're in that position of peace and repose, you don't quite have the same motivation that you had in the beginning. So now is actually a more interesting time in terms of showing the film because to some extent the motivating and animus of behind the film is actually absent now.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the first time for Baron to see the film?
No, he's seen the film before. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, gosh, what a cathartic thing, you know, to be able to go through this. And without giving anything away, just in general terms, is there closure for him with his accuser? I mean, how did she's probably not in it other than in conversation.
No, she's not in it. We don't use her name.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it was a little odd, you know, especially at the trial, because it was odd that her family didn't show up, for instance, and her parents didn't show up. So, you know, she played God, and maybe I played God as well. And I think part of the film is about recognizing that. That's maybe something you shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So.
Okay. And as we said, John, your first screening is tomorrow at the Temple Theater, the Temple Har Shalom, so a good appropriate venue for a theme of people playing God. and also following that Wednesday at the Redstone, you're down in Salt Lake later on in the week, and then back at Friday at the Prospector Square Theater and Saturday at the Yarrow Hotel. So John Hartwriter, director and subject from All the Beautiful Things, thank you for being there.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
The Local View is on the air each weekday, 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. right here on KPCW, featuring national news from NPR, international headlines with the BBC, and plenty of local news from our award-winning news department. Interviews, music, your phone calls, lost and found, public service announcements, and I'll be your host. This is Randy Barton. Sponsored by CNS Creative Services, Ramp Sports, Mercer Automotive, and Molly Bloom's Gastro Pub.
Deer Valley Etc. is delighted to support KPCW. Located at the Snow Park Lodge, we offer specialty coffee drinks, sundries, Deer Valley signature food, and select logo items. For information, 649-1000 or deervalley.com.
Okay. And we are back with Sundance on the Weekend, and we're here with Greg Barker, director of We Are the Giant, which is not a sports movie, although the title may make it sound like that. But it's a view of what has been loosely called the Arab Spring, with Greg. It looks like you're looking at about three or four different perspectives on this. And tell us a little bit about the people you're examining in this film, and I mean, for this vast. Just to start with, who are we looking at here?
Well, I think thanks. It's great to be here on a Sunday morning. We had an amazing premiere last night, standing ovation for the film, and most importantly for some of the subjects in the film. And it's really, with an audience, it's really an overwhelming experience. Because I think what people connect with this movie is it's not about – the characters are from the Middle East, but it's actually about something we can all identify with, which is the question of what does one do when confronted with a wrong, in this case injustice or a brutal regime, and how does one then affect change? And I think these people in our stories are making the same kind of very tough decisions that revolutionaries across history have made, people like Martin Luther King and Gandhi, that where you have to then say, okay, I see a clear right here, but then what do I do? What do I do, and how? What's the most effective way of of trying to change something. And that can involve sometimes armed struggle. That can involve nonviolence. But what it always involves is this intense bravery and courage to stand up for an ideals. And I think all of us in our lives, we're faced with choices about what to do for what we actually stand for. And I find personally these people in this film are just deeply inspiring and relatable to all of our experiences.
Well, okay, so this takes place in the Middle East. And just so that people listening can understand what regime and what, you know, what.
Sure, the film, yeah, I mean, it's, yes, exactly. So the film is set in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, the uprisings in, mm-hmm. in Tunisia initially, and then Egypt most famously, that began 3 years ago. And we have three groups of characters from three different countries, a father and a son from Libya, a couple of internet activists from Syria, two guys who actually helped begin what was at the time a nonviolent uprising against Bashar Assad and have continued to stay nonviolent, even though the revolution took a violent turn. And then two sisters from a country called Bahrain, which is a very close U.S. ally right next to Saudi Arabia in the Gulf. It's the home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet. And that part of the film then gets into this very complicated question of what do we stand for as Americans? And we follow these three groups of individuals as they face these challenges. And through them, we get a sense of the kind of the historic choices that they have to make and the dilemmas they face and the incredible pain that some of them endure. And what's extraordinary about it is it's actually a hopeful film. I mean, I've made other films. I made a film once called Sergio, which was here at mm-hmm. Sundance, which was basically about a guy dying inside a rubble after a bomb. And it was an inspiring film. And so I'm actually an optimistic guy, although I spent most of my life sort of overseas and make films about, you know, tough issues around the world. But this isn't it's an optimistic film. And it's hopeful, and that's what I think the audience took away from last night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in terms of you know the destiny of the Arab Spring and the three different venues that you look at, I mean there are concerns about you know, what if you overturn the current authoritarian, a lot of speculation. Just people from here in this country, but will we go from an authoritarian type regime in the particular country to some democracy or just another form of extremism?
I think the Arab Spring, what we call the Arab Spring, is 3 years old. If you look at revolutions across history, 3 years into them, most countries are a mess. Our country was a mess 3 years after the Revolutionary War. Look at France, a bloodbath. Most revolutions take a long time to pan out historically. I think, in a way, we, the general public, was lulled by the last great wave of revolutions, lulled into a sense of like that these things are often quite peaceful, which happened in 1989 in Eastern Europe with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the reason that was peaceful, thankfully, is because the Soviet Union decided not to crack down, which they had done in Eastern Europe before in Czechoslovakia and in Poland, where they crushed uprisings and killed you know lots and lots of people. Look at Tiananmen Square in China in also 1989. The regime there decided to not sort of stand by as protesters turned out in the hundreds of thousands, and they sent troops in and killed a bunch of people, thousands of people. That's the norm. That is the norm. And so the Arab Spring, I think it's just frankly too early to tell how it's going to pan out. And I think it's kind of, it's just not on for us to say, well, look, this is a failure now because, look, it's chaotic. It is chaotic, and we don't know what's going to happen, particularly in a place like Syria. It is, and it's tragic. 100,000 people killed there so far. We can't just sit by and throw up our hands and say this part of the world is a mess. Every part of the world that goes through a revolution where people stand up for justice and individual freedom and overthrow an autocratic regime undergoes a period, usually a long period, of chaos afterwards. It can take decades to pan out.
Is this spring different because it's one that sort of driven a lot by social media and people texting? And
yeah, I mean, it's absolutely. I mean, yeah, I mean that's really part of our film. I mean, two of the two sisters from Bahrain, I mean, are incredibly well known on the internet. One goes by the moniker Angry Arabia, and they have like you know tens of thousands of followers. What's also interesting is that revolutions across time have always used the revolutionaries have always used the most subversive form of communication, whether it's the pamphlets you know during the American Revolution or Twitter today, whatever they can do to get their message out. In a way to undercut the regime, that's what they do. But at the core is just these incredibly brave individuals who are, take risks that most of us think we would do. I mean, what would any of us do if we were in Selma, Alabama during the march there that King led? Mm-hmm. Would we have stood up and marched with him, or would we have sort of run away and gone to our homes and said, okay, it's all too dangerous?
Well, that begs the question, how did you pick these individuals? I mean, because there were a lot of lives touched and probably a lot of stories out there to be told. So there's, what, six? There were six of them?
Yeah, six main characters.
I mean, six main characters. Yeah. How did it filter down to them?
It's like when you make a documentary, you cast a wide net and you look for the strongest stories that both make a point with great characters and also reach a universal audience. And so that's what I look for as a filmmaker. And these stories all really connected with me personally and connect with a wide audience. So they're just, how do we find them? You do a lot of research, you travel, you talk to a lot of people, and eventually you meet someone who's like, this is amazing. I mean, some of the characters in this film are truly memorable. I mean, we cannot get them out of your head, particularly these two sisters from Bahrain who are, young. One's 27, the other's 29. Their father's a human rights activist, and they kind of just begin this kind of – they help begin the uprising, but then they embark on this path that takes them – a place they never would have imagined. One of them's a mother, has to decide whether to take care of her child or help lead the revolution. And she embraces the ideals of nonviolence and goes down this incredibly inspiring but painful for her path. And right now she's still in jail. She's been put in jail for peacefully protesting. And right now on Twitter, hashtag Free Zainab is trending, and that's her name, Zainab Al-Khawaja. She's in jail right now. We're trying to get her out with this film. So that's then after the screening last night, lots of people are suddenly tweeting hashtag Free Zainab.
Yeah, Twitter's the new propaganda bomb, isn't it?
It is.
You come to this from a background of a war correspondent. Come to think of it, war correspondent is not a real safe vocation either, along with protester. We had a team of filmmakers with the film Restrepo 4 or 5 years ago, one of them since deceased. And I don't know if you ever knew Hetherington.
Yeah, Tim Hetherington. Well, I was actually on the Sundance jury that year, and we gave that the grand jury prize. Restrepo was an amazing film. I didn't know Tim well, but, I mean, my producer, John Batsek, executive produced that film. I mean, that was – yeah, he was an amazing, amazing guy. I mean, I don't do that kind of stuff anymore. I have a small family, and I make films. So if I take any risks, I take them. It's very calculated. But part of the reason we tell these stories is because we feel passionately that we got to get out there in the world and figure out what's going on and find ways of relating that to a wide audience.
Was there some degree of hazard for you to make the documentary and deal with these people?
I had an amazing team behind me. I had an Arab American co-producer who spent a lot of time in the field. I mean, there are other people who took far more risks than any of our team did. We had people filming secretly inside Syria for us. One of our cameramen was killed about a year and a half ago, a Syrian freelancer.
Making this film?
He was filming. We don't know what he was filming, whether he was filming for us or he was a freelancer. I mean, he was filming for us during the time that he was killed. I mean, he's one of 100,000. I mean, not to take away the tragedy mm-hmm. of his life, but people have taken great risks to bring this footage out here to Park City. I mean, really, seriously risk their lives every day. So any risk that we, the filmmakers, may have taken is a little self-indulgent to talk about.
Hmm. What is the most film that you have in the feature here? What's the most recent? Where does the story leave off? How far back?
Leaves off. I mean, it's current. I mean, really, it's it really tries to frame the uprising that we've all followed in the news in a kind of broader perspective, a human perspective, and make it relatable to people through these extraordinary individuals, and then to pose the question of what would any of us do, like I say, if we were around during the civil rights movement or other key moments in history, would we have taken up arms during the Revolutionary War? I mean, it's these kind of I've always been intrigued as a filmmaker by moments of crises because I think they define individuals. Most of us go through our lives, or we don't have to to face really defining decisions like, you know, what do I do if someone in front of me is about to be killed? I made a film once about Rwanda where a lot of people face that question. Mm-hmm. What do you do? This film is full of characters who have faced choices like that all the time and make these extraordinary decisions that both are help define themselves and also echo across time and history. So we see in the film these waves of history flowing across. It's hard to describe, but it's these extraordinary, beautiful graphics that we've incorporated in the film that give you a sense of the historical perspective, which resonates deeply in the lives of our characters. They talk about it. They're inspired. One of these Bahraini sisters are inspired by Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. They read Roots and said, wow, look at what these people, look what African Americans went through to get their freedom. We've been suffering we've been enduring this for 3 years. That's nothing compared to what African Americans had to endure. You know, so you can't give up.
Yeah.
The net screening for We Are the Giant is actually today in the afternoon.
Yes, at Redstone.
Yes.
3 o'clock.
And you're down at Salt Lake on Tuesday, and then your last showing here at the festival is Saturday 5:30 over at The Mark.
That's right. Okay. I hope people can come. Thank you.
Greg, thank you very much.
My
Thanks
pleasure.
For coming.
Okay. Thank you.
KPCW presents Park City Stories, hosted by Leslie Thatcher and heard on Friday throughout the day. Supported by C2Ski, property management and concierge service provider for Park City's vacation homeowners. C2SkiProperties.com. Park City Ski Boot, dedicated to the individual performance ski boot fit. 1100 Iron Horse Drive, ParkCitySkiBoot.com. And Alan Schoenberger Ski Studio, helping Park City learn to ski one turn at a time. 435-640-3103, SkiStudioPC.com.
This is Anita Lewis from Summit County. When searching for a product provider or service, I visit summitcountybusiness.com. Summitcountybusiness.com has hundreds of Summit County services and product providers eager to serve you. When you hire local providers, your dollars stay in the county, helping fund fire and safety, roads and health services. And that makes life better for everyone who lives or visits Summit County. Summitcountybusiness.com. Look here first. The Park City Chamber Bureau and Summit County are nonprofit organizations.
I do believe so. And we're back with Sundance on the Weekend. I'm Rick Bruff and with my co-host Stacy Domalski. And we have a film from the U.S. Dramatic Competition, Cold in July. And with the director is here with us, Jim Mickle. And you fed your first showing, what was it, yesterday, Jim?
Yeah, yesterday at 5:30 we premiered.
Okay, so how was that? How was the reaction? Did they scream and yell at all the proper moments?
They did. It was fantastic. It's funny because, you know, we've mostly done horror films, and we were here last year with a film in Midnight, and this one is a little bit of a departure. It's a 80s noir, and but it's filled with a lot of humor, and it's funny. You know, you spend a lot of time thinking, like, are people going to respond to that? Is that going to go over? And amazingly well, it went over last night.
Describe it as kind of Texas noir or
Texas noir?
Yeah, give us a little thumbnail of.
Yeah, so it's in the era. It's in the vein of a Blood Simple kind of a film. You know, it's like there's. That or Red Rock West or One False Move, these sort of 80s sort of subgenre of Southern noir. So this one is about a guy who wakes up in the middle of the night to find a burglar in his living room, and by accident he kills the guy in self-defense, and then finds out that the guy's father has just gotten out of prison, and he comes to town looking for revenge. And from there, the movie morphs 3 or 4 times and becomes a lot of different things before the end.
So where it ends up is, I mean, that I guess that's the whole fun of playing with the audience is trying to, you know, I bet you didn't know we were going to end up here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, and I would think the dad, just knowing you and your horror background, which I love horror. I'm a huge horror fan, so I'm looking forward to seeing this movie, that the ex-con dad is kind of the boogeyman, you know, who shows up and is he around the corner? Is he under the bed? Is
It's a little, you know, it's based on a book by an author named Joe Lansdale, and he's kind of known for throwing a lot of different genres up in a pot and mixing them around and coming out with something completely unique and unpredictable. And this, you know, for a while feels like Cape Fear. It has a good sense of, like, old throwback. Night of the Hunter has a good sense of, like, oh, great, I could watch this movie for a half an hour, and or for the rest of the movie, and then every half hour it sort of turns upside down and becomes something else. And so it's a cool experience. I read the book and I thought I'd never read a story like this where I don't know where things are going to go and I can just sort of give into it. And it's almost like hearing a story for the first time. You're not trying to guess what's going on. You can just sort of sit back and enjoy it. So from the response last night, it felt like the audience had that same response.
Sort of like at Halloween going through the haunted maze thing that they have where you could, the haunted corn maze, you know.
Yes, yes. Our ending of the movie was structured very much on that. I won't give any more away.
Oh, yeah, working with some fairly well known names. You had Michael C. Hall, who that's better known as Dexter.
Yep.
And it's taking him in a. This is about violence and death and things, but are you taking him in a somewhat different direction?
Yeah, very, very, very much. I mean, he plays an ordinary guy, you know, and what was fun is I think, you know, for between 6 Feet Under and Dexter, he's played some pretty serious, you know, scarred individuals over the course of 14 years now. And what was fun about this is he plays the most average, normal, all-American, you know, small-town dad, and he does it brilliantly, brilliantly. And it's set in the late 80s, and he just nails that whole thing. So what I was most excited about was how much he was able to sink into something completely different, make you forget his TV shows. And same thing for Don Johnson. Mm-hmm. He comes along at some point and just completely just reminds you how darn good he is.
And Sam Shepard, too.
And Sam Shepard, Sam's incredible. I think it's one of his best roles of his career, and he's it's great because they're three wildly, wildly, wildly different people and wildly different actors and characters. And part of the charm is that they're all thrown into this situation together. And it was a little bit like that with the actors themselves because they're all come from very different backgrounds. But it's like this sort of ragtag trio of people that make it work.
So Sam and Don are the bad guys, right? Are they, or can we even go there?
Yeah, there's that's We're part not of the sure. fun of the movie is we don't know who is. So
okay.
In terms of let me go back a little bit to your film at Sundance last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, We Are What We Are.
Yep.
Which gave a whole new meaning to the phrase. It's really important for families to have dinner together.
Yeah. Yes.
Nicely said, Rick. Okay, we'll just let that one hang.
Yes, it's kind of a gothic family little grisly theme there. If you want to know what more, if you haven't seen the picture,
see it.
Put it on the Netflix queue.
Yeah,
right?
It just came out last week on Blu-ray, and it's on VOD and all that stuff.
So how did it do over the past year?
Great, fantastic. We premiered it here. We finished, you know, a couple days before the festival, and we premiered it. From there, it wound up going to – it got picked up by E1. They distributed it in the fall. It ended up going to Director's Fortnight and played Cannes in May. And that 1-2 punch was – I could retire there and be happy after Sundance and Cannes with a weird little horror film. But it was great. It played all over. It got amazing reviews. You know, I was very proud of it because it's a weird one and it's hard to market and it's hard to figure out how to tell people what it is.
Those are always the best kind of movies, though.
I think so, too. But, you know, I was very proud of the performances in that. And there was a lot of stuff that the very non-horror stuff was the stuff that I was the proudest of in that. And I was really happy that was the stuff that got recognized and picked up on, and it really paved the way for this, you know, because this is a book that we had picked up 6 years ago and had been trying to get made for years and years, and I thought this is never going to happen. And by the time I was here last year, I remember coming here and thinking, like, we're never going to make Cold in July. It's just never going to happen. You know, we're never going to get that green light. We're never going to get the cast that we want. We're never going to – it's never going to come together. And it was really coming out of here with We Are What We Are last year that I think let people take a chance on this. And so to come back a year later is, you know, surreal.
Back to back.
In many different ways, yeah.
With the record of We Are What We Are and, you know, other past films that – does that give you the confidence to handle actors like Johnson and Shepard?
Yeah.
And you have the record now that they can have the confidence in you?
Yeah, definitely. I think, in a weird way, I think, you know, I wasn't ready to make this movie at the time that we picked it up, because at the time we had just done one very small little DV movie with some friends, and it had done well, but that was when we optioned this book. And I think it wouldn't have, in a way, I don't think we would have been able to make this movie then. It almost took... we did two other movies in the meantime, and it let me get a lot of things out of my system and play and learn and figure out and have the confidence to do stuff. So we take a lot of risks with this film stylistically and narratively, and let the actors take a lot of risks. I think I probably wouldn't have been ready to do that at that point. But Michael Parks is in We Are What We Are, and Kelly McGillis and Bill Sage, and a lot of really incredible actors that, you know, you just have a comfortability. Yeah. You know, you're not completely awestruck. You're awestruck, but you can also collaborate.
Yeah, and I noticed one guy that is in this film, Cold in July, that it just flashed on me that he was in last year.
Yeah.
Wyatt Russell.
Yeah. He's amazing.
Russell relatives just swarming around Park City now with the battered bastards of baseball. But Wyatt is you're starting to form a stock company.
I love Wyatt. I met him for We Are What We Are, and I thought, you know, he's Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn's son, and Kurt Russell's my favorite actor of all time. And I thought, you know, that's cool and all, but there's about no chance that this guy Wyatt is going to be very good. And he came in and auditioned. It blew me away. And he played the role that he plays last year is the complete opposite of the role that he plays this year, and he does them both equally well. So he's amazing. He's going to be a star.
Well-deserved. So real quick, what's your chances of getting Kurt Russell in a in the gothic Texas shoot 'em up zombie picture?
I spent our party last night drunkenly concocting that with him. I hope he wakes up and remembers.
Should have got it on paper. Yeah. Here, sign this, dude.
Can you just
We got something to maybe looking for next year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. coming up for Cold in July, you're down in Salt Lake on Monday, but Tuesday you're back at the Eccles.
Back
but
at the
1,300
Eccles.
People watching your movie.
Yep.
Library Center on Thursday, and your wrap-up is at the Redstone on Saturday. So, Jim, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
The ABC4 Weather Report comes to you live Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. after the NPR News, brought to you by Albion Financial Group.
We're back with Sundance in the Morning, and a special guest that we don't usually get on some of these weekend shows is Cooper, John Cooper, who is, let's see, what is your exact title, except for the czar of all the films?
I'm the director of the Sundance Film Festival.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And came by to talk to us about a new concept you introduced for this festival is the failure conference or failure day. So what's the idea behind this?
Yes, it is all about failure. But we were looking for the 30th anniversary. We were thinking what something we can do to mix it up. We thought, let's take a day and theme it out. We didn't know what the theme was going to be at first, but we wanted to call attention to one aspect of the creative process. And so we kind of came up with failure. It's very the most probably the most important part of the creative process, mm-hmm. but also the one that's most denied and overlooked and scared and that goes sort of left untalked about even after it happens. So we thought, let's just pull it all out in a real fun way. So all the activities we usually do with the Cinema Cafe and New Frontier, and we're doing a big panel in the Egyptian that are all based on the idea of failure in the creative process.
And what you can get out of that is not just put your tail between your legs and go away, but what can you learn from it?
And hopefully start talking in ways where you move through it faster, where it's more expected of what you're doing instead of sort of something that's of shame.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about the screening you're going to have that is
kind of
pointed at yourself. It's the failure of the programmers, as you might characterize it.
Yeah, because we thought, we can't really do this without looking at ourselves, of course, or it'd be just that would be cheating. So we thought, let's go back and find a film that we failed to show the first time around. And that would be – the one we chose was Bottle Rocket. Wes Anderson, of course, kicked off his career. Luke Wilson and his brother Owen Wilson were both, created it. So we decided we're just going to show it. And Luke Wilson's going to be there at the screening. And then I found out when I called Luke to come to it, he goes, I submitted a short that – this year that you failed to show. So it just gets deeper and deeper.
It's like, since you asked, let me also point this out.
So now we're going to look at that short again and see if we failed on that one. We might even show that as part of it.
Yeah. Were you around on the program staff when Bottle Rocket was submitted?
Oh, yes. Well, actually, because I was doing the shorts then. I showed the short film, Bottle Rocket, came from a short, 2 years before that. And then I just moved over into features, and it came through. So I knew them, sort of through the film. But, yeah, so I was part of it.
The short did show.
Yes.
But the feature did not.
Right.
So what was her reaction when you called with this idea? It's like, so now you come crawling back.
30 years later.
Actually, Wes Anderson, he doesn't really have to worry about things like this anymore.
Did he go, John, who?
No, he was actually really sweet. I sent him an email. He's in Europe preparing for Budapest Hotel to open Berlin. He goes, that's a crazy idea. I love this so much. I wish I could be there. I really wanted him to come, but I'm really glad that we just – actually talking about failure is very liberating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me tell you one story that maybe would help put it into better context for you is in the early, early days of the festival, embryo days in the late 70s, when the films were – it was just a group of Salt Lakers choosing a few pictures and they'd send a couple of dozen. I'm told that in one of those years that they passed on David Lynch's Eraserhead.
Ooh.
So I wanted to make you feel better.
Okay.
You're in good company.
That's right up there.
We're not – you're not the only one. But is it – you're going to – will failure day be an annual? Well, I mean, will we see every year? Maybe one of the ones you let
that got
get away.
Away.
I think I might keep that going. We probably won't do a failure whole day again, but I'm kind of thinking it might be good to do one film a year. I'm happy to double back and correct things. So
I love it when film festivals and Sundance has done this before too with the Coen brothers, and I love retrospectives where you go back and especially if something changed about it, was digitally remastered or something
it
is a little bit different. I love going back and watching those films on the big screen.
Yeah, we're also doing Clerks and Hoop Dreams.
Yes.
Which were both remastered. So, but that's part of the Sundance Collection, which is part of more archiving instead mm-hmm. of more failure.
I know, but it's the whole idea of failure of bringing back ones that are not in the archive, but did come by somebody's desk.
We have a short list. we can go on for a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of discussing failure, are we looking at I mean, the idea of somebody submitting a film to Sundance, and first the odds of getting the film into Sundance, then the odds of the film being a success at Sundance, then the odds of it going out into the world and being a success, the odds are in favor of failure are tremendous.
Tremendous, right. And but we want to make sure that everyone has the right kind of the right head on when they do this, because you made a film. You haven't really failed at anything.
No, you've got that up.
You created something. You had a vision. I don't want ever – we want to get filmmakers to not think about all those things going into the process. They just have to make what they need to make. And then I think most of the time when you stay really true to your goals, you rarely fail.
Well, I think that's the whole key. You have to ask yourself, why am I making this film? If you're making the film to – be famous or get into a specific festival, that's not
you're
a reason.
Already, yeah, you're
dead. Hosed.
Yeah.
You're already, but if you're making it because it's a passion or it's been a burning desire and it's a goal,
right?
You're right. As soon as it's done, you win. It's
right.
A win.
Yep.
Is there any such thing as the when you have looked at thousands and thousands of films over the years, are there people that have undaunted failures. Do you have people that have submitted films to you 2, 3, 4 times, and you never accept them, but they keep making movies?
Yeah, we do. And I won't mention their names.
Yeah.
Because there's but it's true. And sometimes too, we've had films. There's a few films in the festival this year where they failed a few times with the same film, and then finally. Basically, sometimes it's just you didn't get it right. You thought you were Watchers of the Sky is a documentary that's absolutely beautiful now. That it kept coming in, it just wasn't all the way there. It just didn't gel. And even though the story was amazing, the film wasn't there yet. And it was heartbreaking every time because it's such a major subject on genocide. But finally, she found the tone and it clicked and it. Adi Belzberg is her name. She got it this year. So sometimes failure means going back and recorrecting and coming back with success.
Well, I think failure can breed tenacity.
Yeah.
And with that you wouldn't have had you not had that setback.
Right. And if you don't have tenacity, you might not – shouldn't be in this business.
Oh, my gosh.
it's a tenacious business.
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it'll eat you if you don't if you don't have tenacity.
We're looking for a good, healthy attitude towards failure.
Yeah. And speaking of tenacity and effort and possible failure, I did want to –
Are you talking about my life now? okay.
No, not that one. But the clip video display at the Egyptian, is that
awesome. I love that.
Have you seen it? Been by twice around midnight and it hasn't been working. So
I was working last night. I was on Main Street.
It was. Okay.
Yeah, last night.
They turn it off about. I think they're turning it off around 10:30.
Oh, but okay. So that's.
You need to get out there a little earlier.
Earlier. So that's not a topic for the failure conference.
No, I thought that. I was walking.
No, that thing's been amazing.
It's incredible. I was walking down the street and all of a sudden I hear these people talking and I look around and I'm. What is this? And I look up on the Egyptian.
And it looks beautiful all the time.
Oh,
they're doing
yeah.
these kind of pop art things on it. And then, but it's from the Clip Collective. But then they tell a story. It goes into a story. And you can start the story with a hashtag.
Mm.
So you can send something to Twitter and it'll kick the story in. And it's about a projectionist, putting in different movies and different characters. And it's really amazing.
I was on my way to get in line for something and I actually stood there for like a few minutes and watched it. It just totally sucked me in. I thought it was great.
Yeah, and just finally, just not to suck up to you, but I mean, there's some changes you've introduced to the festival as the director that have been successful. Like instead of one premiere, instead of 3 or 4 different premieres
for opening night,
for
day
opening
one.
Night and. And the now legendary Film Church,
where
you and Trevor are Johnny and Ed.
Yes, yes. That's what happens when you get people so tired, they just say everything.
Yeah.
That's true.
So, okay. Well, John Cooper, thank you for coming by. And you've still got about 7 days to go. So
I know.
Good luck.
And you look bright-eyed and bushy-tailed early on a Sunday morning. We'll see next Sunday, a week from today.
Yes. I'll be something else tailed.
Well, thank you for coming in.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate it.
KPCW and the Park City Museum present the weekly series Park City History Bits. Learn a nugget of local history. A new bit debuts every week. Park City History Bits, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Only in Park City, only on KPCW. Sponsored by Julie Hopkins of Keller Williams Real Estate.
Additional funding for KPCW has been provided by Right at Home, 1745 Bonanza Drive, Furniture and Home Accessories Consignment. Gallery Mar, fresh contemporary art on Main Street, gallerymar.com. Park City Gynecology, Park City Med Aesthetics, Women's Healthcare, Age Management, 435-214-5335. Rally Interactive, makes apps, websites, and other digital products. Rallyinteractive.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
All right, you are listening to KPCW at 91.9 FM in Park City and Heber Valley, 88.1 FM in Camas and Colville, and you might be catching us online at kpcw.org. We're coming up on 1 minute after 9 o'clock, and we'll go to NPR News for 5 minutes, and then we will continue with Rick Brough and Stacey Domosky and Sundance on the Weekend. 29 degrees outside the Sweet Alley Studio, 18 degrees by the Park City Golf Course. Our high today will be around 37.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. A bomb attack on a military convoy in Pakistan has killed at least 20 people, most of them soldiers. NPR's Philip Reeves reports the Taliban is claiming responsibility.
Bombings are daily events in Pakistan, but this is a particularly serious setback for the Pakistani military. The blast hit a vehicle in an army convoy inside a military area that's supposed to be secure. It happened near the town of Banu, and targeted troops were about to be rotated into nearby North Waziristan, a militant hotbed. This is the latest entry in a list of recent Taliban attacks, which include the assassination of a senior anti-terrorism police officer in the city of Karachi and the gunning down of three employees of a TV news station. Pakistan's government's been talking about negotiating peace with the Taliban, but there's little sign the militants are interested. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Islamabad.
In Thailand, at least 28 people are injured after two explosions at an anti-government protest site in the capital, Bangkok. Demonstrators have been blocking several major intersections in the city since Monday as they try to bring down the government. The BBC's Jonathan Head has more from the Thai capital.
The two explosions occurred, one right after the other, at Victory Monument, normally one of Bangkok's busiest road intersections, but which has been partially blocked by anti-government protesters for the past week. The incident follows a grenade attack on a protest rally on Friday, which killed one man and injured nearly 40. No one has admitted responsibility for that attack. The protest leader has blamed the government, although Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat has denied any official involvement.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Bangkok. In Ukraine's capital, tens of thousands of demonstrators are defying new laws aimed at ending the ongoing anti-government protests there. The protests first erupted last year after President Viktor Yanukovych refused to sign a cooperative agreement with the European Union in favor of closer ties with Russia. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's office is denying another political accusation, this one by the mayor of Hoboken. Dawn Zimmer says the Christie administration withheld millions of dollars in Hurricane Sandy recovery funds because she refused to support a commercial development project Christie's office was pushing. A Christie spokesman calls it a partisan attack. Christie's office is being investigated for allegedly creating traffic on the George Washington Bridge linking New Jersey and New York City. But it's not the traffic that New York residents complain about most. It's the noise. Jennifer Olson lives in Queens.
I basically live next to LaGuardia Airport, and all these trucks with like all the food for the airport, they just come going down my street at like 5 in the morning, and I really don't appreciate that.
A city hotline received more than 260,000 calls about noise last year. This even though New York City has one of the nation's toughest noise codes. This is NPR. American Hustle is the winner of this year's Screen Actors Guild Award for Outstanding Cast, boosting its already strong Academy Awards prospects. NPR's Jim Hawk has more on last night's awards ceremony.
Winners in the film category include Matthew McConaughey as Best Actor for Dallas Buyers Club. Best Actress went to Cate Blanchett for Blue Jasmine. Jared Leto was voted Best Supporting Actor for Dallas Buyers Club. And Lupita Nyong'o as Best Supporting Actress in 12 Years a Slave.
My dad, I called him. He was the first person I called when I got this role. And I said to him, Daddy, do you know Brad Pitt? I'm going to be in a movie with him. And he said, I don't know him personally, but I'm glad you got a job.
In the television category, the comedy series cast award went to Modern Family, the drama series cast award went to Breaking Bad, and 82-year-old Rita Moreno won SAG's Lifetime Achievement Award. Jim Hawk, NPR News.
Tennis champion Serena Williams is out of the Australian Open. 14th seed Ana Ivanovic of Serbia won her first victory over Williams after five tries.
Just tried to give my best, you know, and tried to make it a good match. And, you know, I was very competitive till the last moment, and I'm just very thrilled.
Williams was apparently hindered by a back injury. This brings her bid for an 18th Grand Slam title to an end. Serbia's Ivanovic advances to the quarterfinals. This year's Super Bowl contenders will be decided today. First up, the Denver Broncos host the New England Patriots for the AFC Championship at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And at 6:30 Eastern, the NFC's Seattle Seahawks host the San Francisco 49ers. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
I'm Samantha Browning with Park City Mountain Resort, a proud KPCW supporter. We're hosting kids' opera parties every Saturday from 3 to 5 p.m. with a different theme every week. ParkCityMountain.com for a full event schedule. Park City Mountain Resort is celebrating its golden anniversary all season long.
And we're back with Sundance on the Weekend, and I'm here with my co-host, Stacy Domalski, and we're here with Madeline. Is that how you say it?
Madeline. Any way you want to say it.
Who was famous for coming up with some of the most distinctive titles for Sundance Pictures. Two years ago, we talked to you for Codependent Lesbian Space Alien Seat Same.
That's right.
And, mm-hmm. And now you got Foxy Merkins.
The Foxy Merkins, yes.
And I'll let you, just before we get into the premise, just if you can, for people who don't exactly know what a Merkin is, can you define that for that would be radio friendly?
Oh, I see. I almost want to have you say it then, because so little of what I say is radio friendly.
It is. My understanding is it is kind of something that's appropriate for a lady's genital area, kind of a something in the way of a toupee.
That is correct. I am very impressed with the breadth of your knowledge. Yeah, as always, even last time I remember how you contextualized the lesbian space aliens, and this time the Merkin is similarly. Yes.
Well, you have some hidden talents here.
You do. I would say. Well, we may call upon you in the future,
okay,
too.
I think I know this area of expertise because last year there was a Sundance movie from Sebastian Silva, the South American director, had a couple of films. One of those was with an American actress who played kind of a vagabond hippie-type chick who had a couple of scenes with extensive full nudity, full frontal nudity. And in the audience Q&A afterwards, she confided to people that that people had approached her at parties and asked her if she had been wearing a Merkin for the full frontal. And she said, no, I didn't.
That's all me.
The foliage there. The
it's
foliage
so impressive,
there.
You know, that
the
range of
there is
talents.
Fine.
Yes.
God-given.
Yes. And anyone that comes up to me on the street and pays me $1, I can tell you who that actress is.
Oh, okay.
Because she blabbed it to an audience in the Prospector Square Theater, so it's not a big secret.
It's probably out there on YouTube somewhere.
You know what, Rick? I would like to add that as a prize on my Kickstarter campaign because we're still raising funds for our movie. You can find us on Kickstarter. Just do a search of the Foxy Merkins plus Kickstarter. But we have different prizes, and one could be that Rick will tell you who that actress was. And I don't think we should say $1. I think we'll make it higher. Okay. Level prize amount, and I can easily add that.
I'll go with it. Yeah.
All right.
For the sake of Kickstarter.
That would be amazing,
yes.
Actually.
Mm-hmm. And maybe we can get to that topic
sure.
A second later, but tell us about the premise of this.
Well, the Foxy Merkins is a comedy about two lesbian hookers on the streets of New York. So it's set in a world where there are these lesbian hustlers who are picked up by housewives and Republican women. It's a world that does not exist currently, but it was inspired by movies that I love, iconic male hustler films such as Midnight Cowboy and My Own Private Idaho, where you get to see these wonderful adventurous tales, except this time told in this world of women. So as I mentioned, it is a comedy. That was it. What word did that come from? Someone got
please,
a text.
Maybe
someone was asking, who was that actress?
Yes.
I'll pay money.
Yes.
Exactly.
Please turn off your electronic devices before we begin the interview.
That is correct. We actually shot the movie on the streets of New York, in many different locations. And it has a feel of reality to it, which to my mind, just heightens the comedy.
So were any instances of maybe the cast
Yes. Accidentally
rounding up some business?
Say that again. Were they rounding up business on the street?
Yeah.
No. But no, actually, that is how we paid for the movie. No, I'm kidding.
It's one of your Kickstarter
exactly rewards.
Yeah.
What's interesting for me as a director is that I've been able to work with some great actors. I live in New York City. We have a very vibrant downtown theater scene. So we have actors who are literally on stage every week. I know it's a struggle for actors. I know, especially in LA, you can often go years and just have a small part on a sitcom. But for actors coming from the New York area, there's so many opportunities to act that there's a real level of craft. They hone their craft every week, and so I have all these truly wonderful actors, and many of them were in Codependent, Lesbian Space Alien Seek Same, and even going back to my first two shorts at Sundance. This is the fourth time I'm at Sundance with a film. I co-wrote the movie with the two main actors, Lisa Haas and Jackie Monahan, who were also in Codependent, Lesbian Space Alien Seek Same. And anyway, we just wanted to make a kind of movie, a totally outrageous comedy. Someone said, you know, you should be high when you're watching this film, which I took as a compliment, even though I am not a pot smoker. But we also, totally sober people, also enjoy the picture. We're just so excited to be here. And it is our first screening on Monday, although we actually premiered – Sundance had another festival in L.A. last summer.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's where we had our world premiere, and it went so great. We had our first screening. We had our second screening. Some people from the first screening came back to see the second screening. And then Sundance was so happy with how it went, they asked me to apply to the festival. So.
Mm-hmm. And so you shot on the streets of New York.
Yes, we did.
So were there any outside of somebody coming up going, hey, I'll take what you're selling?
Exactly.
Were there any other kind of, because of the subject matter of hooking?
Yes.
Any interesting little tidbits of something that happened that from shooting live on the streets of New York?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the funny things that happen – of course, are annoying to us because, you know, if someone comes in and interrupts our picture. The thing, though, is that our crew is so small when we are acting. People often can't tell the movie's being
exactly.
shot.
That's kind of where I was going.
Exactly. So there's stuff going, okay, here, I'll tell you, you're right. I'm trying to, it was racking my brain. One of the main characters is down on her luck hustler. She's new at it. And she's also severely asthmatic, like the character. So we did stage an asthma attack in Bloomingdale's in New York. And she's so good at it. Like, the saleswoman was like, call 911, you know.
No, leave her alone.
And other times, like, literally, when we did look like a movie with a big, big boom and, you know, it's Lisa had her asthma attack and this woman came up to me and she was like, you need to tell people that this is acting because it looks real. And I'm like, I'm holding a boom. That person has a camera. How more stage?
But Lisa's face is turning blue.
It totally does turn blue. Like, I have to say, it is extraordinary. I mean, I know that they talk about how actors become the characters, but you do think she's going to die at several points during the movie in a totally funny way. Mm-hmm. But the asthma, it's truly unfortunate. Thing for a hooker to struggle with.
Excuse me, and has to get her inhaler out.
Totally,
right?
it's part of the comedy of the movie. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, in both films, like Codependent and this, are do you feel comfortable that you're getting into a niche of, well, what would you say it? Something that's kind of goofy and out there, but also getting into some genuine things about female characters or the issues that they really have to deal with.
I like to think of it when people sort of worry, when filmmakers worry about, oh, being labeled or being put into a corner. I always think it always just sort of depends on what the label is. Like, no one has any trouble with being called beautiful and talented. So I don't have any problem being called the goofy filmmaker. Especially, you know, there are so many serious movies and I think it's great that we make movies that people laugh and enjoy. I think that has meaning too, because I think the biggest thing a movie can do is change your life for the hour and a half you're watching
it. You lose yourself in it.
Yes, totally. And we like to think that we're providing comic relief for how incredibly difficult the rest of everyone's lives are with our goofy stories. That's the meaning for me, is creating comedy. And for all of the people working on the film, many of whom work in the field of comedy, it's something that's we take very seriously. It's very important to us. And we do a million takes on a scene. We edit through a million versions of the picture. It's a very precise art to be this silly and goofy. Mm-hmm. So,
and have it transcend up on the screen to appear just off the cuff and lighthearted.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have too much time. Just briefly talk about the Kickstarter.
Yeah, I'll talk about my Kickstarter campaign. You know, a lot of people come to Sundance and they feel very far away from the action. We do have a Kickstarter as a fundraising campaign on the internet. You go to the Kickstarter website, kickstarter.com, and it's a way of a lot of our prizes often involve the actors and phone calls from the actors. Mm-hmm. And you can actually even potentially get a producing title on a Sundance picture through a Kickstarter donation, one of our prize levels. But it's really a wonderful way for people who feel like that they're just barely part of the crowds at Sundance to have a personal involvement with the movie, because you do hear from us when you make a donation, no mm-hmm. matter what level. And we are trying to get this movie out, distribution ready, out to the wider public. And mm-hmm. it's an important piece of our journey that you would be coming along with us for. And the only last thing I wanted to say was, and you can do it at bit.ly. Be a Foxy Merkin is another way to find on the web, but the Foxy Merkins search on Kickstarter. And just that, even though it says we are waitlisted for our movies, I've been hearing stories that so many people go to parties that they don't leave, that there are a lot of that. The big piece of information I can give you to your show today is you see the movie sold out, the E-list is sold out, and people are still getting into mm-hmm. various screenings.
I've heard that too.
So people should know that, because There are seats generally available for things that say they're sold out, is what I've been hearing. And we have our first screening Monday. So,
And let me run down the schedule briefly. You're launching to Monday at the Prospector Square Theater. Tuesday, you're at the Temple Har Shalom. Interesting topic for the Jewish Synagogue Theater.
Sure.
And finally, Friday at the Redstone Cinema. And I'll leave it up to you, Madeline. But feel free to go on. And
yes.
For a $50 donation, we'll tell you
$50,
the
that's fabulous.
We'll
Rick will tell you personally who that actress is. I'm telling you, I'm going home and adding that prize right now.
Yeah, we'll tell you the actress who went Merkin free.
That is a great prize.
Yay,
thanks, Madeline.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back.
Thank
we'll
you both you. So much. This is wonderful.
This is Earl with Nexus IT. Nexus IT is proud to sponsor KPCW. Nexus IT provides computer and network services and products for businesses and residential clients in Summit and Wasatch County. Our phone number is 487-9099 and on the web at nexusitc.net.
No, it's Sundance in the Sundance in the morning, and I'm here with co-host Stacy Domalski and the director of another interesting dramatic feature, and this is called Lowdown, and we got Jeff Price with us. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, hi.
Okay.
Great to be here.
Sounds interesting on a couple of different levels, but just tell us the basic story here.
The basic story is a kid growing up, a young girl, in the 1970s in Los Angeles, and her father is an artist, has some interesting problems. He's a jazz musician, and kind of burdened with a heroin addiction, a very uncomfortable relationship with the law.
Okay, and it's actually based on a true jazz musician, right?
It's based on a memoir by mm-hmm. Amy Jo Albany, and she is the daughter of Joe Albany, mm-hmm. who is a musician, bebop, piano player, little known, very, very interesting career, was around pre-bebop, playing with the jazz greats, was Charlie Parker's piano player mm-hmm. in Los Angeles in the mid-40s, really poised for kind of legendary fame and really... worthy of legendary fame. Mm-hmm. And no one quite understands what happened. He was fired by Charlie Parker just before what are considered to be his best recordings. And I think in some ways that hurt Joe so terribly. And he was an interesting, literate guy. His friends were... He was hanging out with Terry Southern mm-hmm. and Lenny Bruce. But he... played in clubs and he played in joints, and in the 60s he had a daughter. His wife left after a few years, and Joe is left to raise this kid alone, single dad, heroin addict,
jazz musician
running from the law, on probation, always one iota away from catastrophe. And that's our story.
Yeah, with a background in experimental films and shooting documentaries, mm-hmm. and I think that the two, as our note said, you did shot two for Bruce Weber that I think played in past film festivals.
Yeah.
Quite a few years ago.
Yeah.
Broken Noses and Let's Get Lost. And yeah. Let's Get Lost was... remind me, that was wasn't that also a musician?
Yeah, that was the story of Chet Baker.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, well, okay, this is my story. I'm just, you know, I'm coming to feature films a little late in life, and I'm a lifelong filmmaker. But my filmmaking came out of a—I'm a little obsessive-compulsive. I came out of loving home movies. And I, at age 12, was handed an 8mm movie camera. And really what I love to do is film. And I just am, everyone that knows me knows that I have a movie camera with me every day. I'm always taking a movie of something. And that led me to becoming, I guess, for lack of a better term, an experimental filmmaker. And in, gosh, it was so long ago now, 25 years ago, Bruce Weber looked at these silent 8mm films and he thought, oh, well, let's just make some films together. Because the way you do it, we could just, you know, you don't need a crew. You just get up and you just start shooting. So we were both mad jazz fans. And Chet Baker, we had a little bit of, we idolized just a little bit. I mean, we had a kind of, you fall in love with Chet Baker. And the act of filming is so often the act of falling in love. You look at a person and you get that gaze of love. And this is how love is expressed in movies, through this kind of gaze. Any movie where someone falls in love needs to have a moment where there's a gaze into the camera, which is playing the perspective of the other person. And that gaze drove us mad, that we would do anything to find that gaze in our day-to-day life. So we followed Chet Baker for a year, kind of obsessively, and we made that film, Let's Get Lost, which somehow, I don't know why, but after that film, I was working as a director of photography. It was always a little bit awkward because I came up with a different kind of mentorship than most DPs. And it wasn't until I met Amy Jo Albany, she was working on my crew, and I'm like, Albany? And it turns out her father is Joe Albany. And I was like, really? I love your father's music. Oh, well, by the way, I grew up in these sort of crazy transient hotels in Los Angeles. Oh, tell me more. And here we are.
And as you said, making the jump to feature films relatively late, so what finally got you to jump?
To do it? No, it was just caring, loving that story. And I couldn't get enough of Amy's story. It became a little bit of an obsession, like our obsession with Chet Baker, like my love of filming, which I do in a way as an obsession. And I couldn't get enough of listening to Amy tell stories. She has.
Was it hard to get her to open up, or
you know? Yeah. Yes. Until she found that I was a fan of her dad's.
Mm.
And I don't, you know, Joe Albany's a very obscure musician. So she, it's not every day she comes across someone that's.
Knows her dad.
Knows her dad. So, she started telling me stories and she wrote a beautiful memoir, which our film is basically an adaptation of.
Mm-hmm.
So creating this, you know, person based on a real person, but it's being done by an actor in this case. And yeah. what kind of a gaze did you want to get the audience to direct at?
Yeah,
John Hawks.
Yeah, well, you know, we have this amazing cast: John Hawks, Elle Fanning, Glenn Close, Peter Dinklage, Flea. Mm-hmm. If the cast, it doesn't make any sense. How did that cast come together? For me, it didn't make any sense. Well, the answer is the story. And I think these actors, they read the screenplay and it's so convincing. It was so convincing to them. And John, there's no explaining his craft. You say rolling and
he becomes Joe Albany.
He becomes Joe Albany. You look at him, you would swear he was a shapeshifter. And Amy was very involved in the film. She was there every day. She was an amazing resource for the actors. And she would come to me and say, the only explanation is magic power. He's doing things that are channeling my father that I never wrote, that I never spoke of.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of huddling between Elle Fanning and Amy. Well, I guess Elle is playing the Amy character.
Yeah, Yeah, we on the set, we had to always say, the real Amy, the fake Amy. I need the real Amy on set. And that was also just a marvel to look at. There was something, it's that idea of going back in time and seeing yourself. Mm-hmm. And there was some real spark of love between the two of them. I've got a few photographs. It's the radio, so we can't look at them, yeah. But they're very beautiful to see next to one another.
Yeah. And an interesting guy in your cast is, you know, that when people say, well, what does Sundance, an independent film, contributed? And one response is a guy like John Hawkes, who has shown his really bloomed and shown what he can do in films that are kind of generally considered independent and stuff that is played at Sundance.
Yeah. John, you know, John had to play the piano.
I was going to ask if John plays the piano before this film. Did
you know, he's a musician.
Is he?
He plays guitar. He's not a jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
He understands the piano from a little bit from being a musician, but he doesn't play. And it was very important to everyone mm-hmm. that there was no ambiguity about the character being the pianist, and he's playing a virtuoso pianist. So we had this absolutely brilliant music director, Ohad Talmor, who had been listening to Joe's solos for years. We worked on the screenplay for 8 years, and Ohad's a dear friend, and he's been, for all that time, listening to the solos, transcribing them, determining what was teachable that wouldn't be easy, that you could pan down to the hands and get it,
mm-hmm.
And work with John. And no one really knew until the day we shot it if it was going to work or not. So it was a very tense day, and we had scheduled John last so that he could really concentrate and really be there, and I was there with the camera, and it's a party scene, a big scene. The music starts. We're playing back a historic recording of Joe Albany. So he's got to match note for note the hands of a virtuoso on cue. One unbroken take, and the camera swings down to his hands, and I'm looking at the viewfinder, and I'm thinking, this isn't happening. It's perfect. And I go back up, and we swing back down to the hands again two or three times. Said cut, I heard a stampede in the hallway, and it was everyone in the video village, all the producers, all shocked and disbelief. No one could believe their eyes bursting into the room.
So it was a one-take thing?
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's John. That's John. Everyone, the actors had such power. Now, again, I'm new to this kind of filmmaking, and I'm working with the great actors alive.
Yeah, and a lot of buzz for Glenn Close, Glenn, I think, in this picture.
When you're there with Glenn and you sense the power of her craft, the artistry that she performs, and I thought, well, I'm seeing one of the great works of all time. I could go in a time machine, try to find something better than that, and I wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. This
is a period piece. I wonder if you can talk a bit
sure.
about evoking the period, because I always hate it when somebody does a clumsy job of period.
Yeah.
They do a picture in the 40s, and
yeah.
they think all they have to do is play in the mood in the background.
Yeah.
But it is so great when they get when somebody gets the period right.
Yeah.
How did you approach that?
I hope we did that, and we've gotten great feedback about it. I'm of the 70s. I can close my eyes and convince myself I'm back then, and unhappily open them. But and Amy Albany is also a great power of memory for these things. So so everything was done carefully, and everything was styled, and
did you have a production designer? And
Elliot Hofstetter was brilliant, and but I think the thing that married it all is we shot on film. And we shot on 16mm.
Oh, wow.
Which is a kind of surface image that just rings the 70s. And people see it. And I've had people say, wow, you got the atmosphere of the 70s in the first shot. And there was very little in the shot. I don't know what I'm responding to that's giving me this sense of being transported. And that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's even the aspect ratio we picked was something that was
More retro.
More of that time.
Mm-hmm.
The lenses we used were kind of optically of that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, I think you've got you've actually got your first showing just
today.
a couple of hours.
I know.
Yeah. And, oh, how
so how do you feel first? Is this the absolute world premiere for the film?
It is.
Is Amy going to be there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
In front of 1,300 people.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a little nervous.
You got the
you have a right to be.
The agonies of the Sundance
director. It's a nervousness that I'm reveling in. It's a very pleasurable sense mm-hmm. of being nervous. I'm loving it. I'm so excited to be here and so proud and grateful to be at Sundance. And one of the things, because I am new to this, so I'm learning things all the time, and one of the things I learned is, well, the film's not finished until you show it to an audience. So in a way, I don't even feel it's going to be finished today in this sort of ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And of all of the places and all of the audiences I could have hoped for, this is the one that was almost in my head when I was making it. So, yeah, I'm rather thrilled.
Oh, well, good for you. We're happy for you, too.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, Jeff, your date with destiny is 12:15 today at the Eccles.
Yeah, my heart rate's
and
going
so
up.
That's our biggest theater, so people listening may have
luck getting in.
Still yes. room. And later on, your Wednesday, you're at the Library Center Theater, Thursday at the Yarrow Hotel, Friday at Prospector Square, and you wrap up on Saturday going down to Provo Canyon and the Sundance Resort. But we're here with Lowdown. And Jeff, thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks.
From New Orleans, it's American Roots and Friends.
Hi, I'm Sharon Jones.
And Bosco Mann.
Hey there, this is John Doe.
Hello, folks, this is Jerry Lewis.
Hey, Will, it's Trombone Shorty.
This is Toots, Frampton Cinematers.
This is Earl Scruggs.
This is Fats Domino.
This is Hugh Masekela.
I'm Elvis Costello.
And I'm Alan Toussaint.
Saying stick with Nick on American Roots.
If you know what I'm saying.
Sunday mornings at 11 on KPCW.
And welcome back to Sundance in the Morning. Rick Bruff here with Stacey Domalski. And we have the director of the movie Hellion, which, Kat Candler, you've had, a couple of screenings up to now, one in Park City and one in Salt Lake.
Yeah, we had our Salt Lake yesterday, which was fantastic. I was telling the audience, I think all the directors who come to Sundance so love the Salt Lake screenings. It's just a sweet, general, great audience. And then our premiere was on Friday. The days are starting to blend, even though we've only been here for 3 days. And that was just like pure magic. It was such a great day.
Are you the type of director, can you stand to sit in the audience when the film is being shown, or do you have to wait outside?
It's funny. I ran into John Cooper at the director's brunch yesterday, and he was telling me I looked very pale right before I went down to go intro. But it was like the butterflies were like crazy inside my belly, and I was just trying to stand up straight and be able to speak, which mm-hmm. I was able to speak. It was great. But yeah, I survived, and it was awesome and wonderful.
Oh, tell us a little bit about Hellion. Just give us the little thumbnail sketch
sure.
so people can.
Yeah, it's about a widowed refinery worker in Southeast Texas who is just grieving by being very absent with his two boys, and his oldest boy, who's 13, is acting in very destructive and delinquent ways. And because of their behavior, the youngest boy gets taken away and placed with his aunt. And so it's about these two men who have to take responsibility for their lives and their actions to bring the youngest brother home.
And the
it's a very uplifting film.
It's not one of the Sundance pictures that in the program notes they have to say, despite its grim subject matter, this is ultimately...
It's very entertaining.
There's lots of laughs in this one.
Well, the father is Aaron Paul.
Yeah.
So this is a young father. This is a kid that has to be a dad.
We reached out to him last April through agencies, and then a mutual friend, James Ponsel, who directed him in Smashed, which is what I saw him in, and just fell in love with Aaron. And he responded to the script in such a sweet, beautiful way and signed on to the project. And when I went out to go meet him while he was making Need for Speed, and actually one of the first questions I asked James was like, is he a nice person? Is he a good human being? And James responded with like a resounding, he is like amazing and such a good person. And sure enough, when I met him, he was just everything that everybody had said. And I was just excited to see him do something we haven't as an audience seen him do before.
Not at all. This is a stretch.
He's so beautiful and so soulful on the screen and connected in such a great way with the kids in the film. And I couldn't have asked for a better performance and better talent to work with.
And Juliette Lewis is...
Yeah, Juliette.
Tell us about her.
I love her. I love her. You know, I've been a huge fan for many, many years, and she's such a joy to work with, and she's such a cool lady. I want to hang out with her and go dancing with her all the time. Yeah, she's pretty great.
Well, tell us about Josh Wiggins. if you do the IMDb thing, he has one credit. This is one credit. Where the heck did...
Where'd you find him?
Okay, yeah. So Josh, I had a short hair called Hellion in 2012, which is kind of how this all snowballed and came to be. And the oldest boy, a friend of ours, Summer Shelton, who is one of the producers on Little Accidents, they were looking for the same age range as boys as we were at the same time. And so we were kind of swapping casting ideas, and she wanted to see the oldest boy from our short, Tommy, who has since retired from acting. He's now skateboarding and being an entrepreneur at the tender age of like 15. And she started researching him online and found these YouTube videos that he made with his best friend, Josh Wiggins. And she reached out to us and was like, you got to check out this other kid in these YouTube videos, and sent me Bad Detective, which they made when they were probably like 10. And he just is such a special presence on screen. And when he walked into the room for the audition, it was like, you know, the heavens opened up and the sun shone down on him, and he opened his mouth, and I'm like, oh my God, this kid's magic. Yeah, yeah, he's so special. And we expected him to get some love, but there's been this outpouring of love for this kid, and people who have seen him are just really responding to him, and I expect great things.
How is he doing? Because he's having the premiere of this film, and again, you go on the Google, and it's saying things like the next Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, that's heavy.
I know, right? He is the sweetest, coolest kid in the world, and he has got such a great head on his shoulders and such an amazing family behind him, and he is taking it in stride. I mean, more so than in some adults that I've seen. He's just a really good-hearted, nice kid, and I couldn't be more proud and more excited. And
180 from the character he plays.
He's not a hellion by any means. He's quite the opposite. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, you know, for people that can't see, you know, Kat is sort of dressed in Part City informal this morning.
Yes.
And I don't know if you haven't been profiled by any cops yet, have you? Or
what do you mean?
You look like kind of a hellion.
No. I actually appreciate that. I've got my little wristbands on.
Yes, I was noticing. I love that.
And my
one.
Heidi braids are in.
It's a good dichotomy going on there.
It's the innocence / metal, I guess. I don't know. Punk rock, I don't know. But I appreciate that. I'm not...
Yeah. We're digging the look. That's what he's trying to say.
Thank you. Yes. I appreciate it.
Yes. The setting for this, maybe you mentioned it, but what area of the country?
It's Southeast Texas. So like Port Arthur, where Janis Joplin is from, small towns, Port Neches, Groves, Nederland. My producer, Kelly Williams, is from that area. So it was like such a community support of this film. Like his folks pretty much like were kind of producers on the film. They made all of the food brought cookies to set.
People slept on their living room floor.
Like five people slept on their living room floor. It was a great community support. And it's a place where there's, if you've seen Urban Cowboy, refineries everywhere. And I just hadn't, outside of Urban Cowboy, I hadn't seen that setting on screen. And it's a good presence in our film and quite a character as well.
And I noticed there's dirt bike aspect to it,
right?
So did Josh get to ride dirt bikes and jump?
No, not at all. Josh, we put him on a bike for one rehearsal on a bike so he could get the feel of it, and he lost control of the bike and was heading towards a tree. We rescued him. He's fine. But after that, I'm like, no, never again. We had a stunt guy who did all of his...
Who did the dirt bike jumps and stuff like that.
But we definitely, when we were casting, I went to a bunch of motocross races, and we found one of our other boys, one of our other little hellions from a motocross race. And bless his heart, like, he is usually on a bike every single day, and he wasn't allowed to ride while we were shooting. So for about a month and a half, he was not allowed to get on his bike, and every day it's like, cat. Can I get on my bike? I'm like, no, Cameron.
Because we can't afford you to break your wrist.
Exactly. I don't need you to be in a sling tomorrow. But yeah, the motocross is pretty.
So all the motocross stunt stuff was done by stunt doubles.
By stunt. Yeah, it was pretty spectacular. And when we finally got sound design on all of that, it was it just came to life.
Oh, I'm sure.
It was awesome.
I'm sure those scenes are great.
Yeah. Some of my favorite.
Yeah. And before making this film, just to briefly wrap up, what was your background leading up to this?
I've been here the last 2 years with shorts, and it's really cool because I think there are like four or five filmmakers here with features who had shorts last year and the year before, and it's been such an organic process for us going from 2012 short and getting the support of the Sundance Institute and the San Francisco Film Society. It's been a really fun, beautiful adventure that we've been on. And I teach. I'm a teacher at the University of Texas as well.
Oh, what do you teach?
I teach film production, like juniors and seniors, undergrad. So I have to go back to school in like a week and a half when I get out of here.
So did you take the time off to do this?
Yeah, I took a semester off, but my friend who was teaching the class every day, I was like, what are you guys learning today? What's going on? How are the kids? What movies are they making? So yeah, I'm anxious to get back.
All right.
Great.
And briefly to review your chances to see the film. And let's see, tomorrow, Monday at the Yarrow in the morning, and Tuesday at the Eccles Theater. You're putting that film in front of those 1,300 people in the Eccles. And finally, Friday at the Library Center Hotel. And it sounds like you're hitting the ground running. So
it's been crazy, but it's been a lot of fun.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for this.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for coming in.
Kat Candler with Hellion. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Are you ready for the games?
No, not those games.
The Groovy Pledge Drive of Love games.
Oh, that sounds intriguing. Tell me more.
Well, people are rushing to sign up. February 10th through February 14th. We'll have the Challenging Challenge Grant Challenge.
Primo Premium Pledge Play.
And online auction bidding bonanza.
You can play all week.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay tuned.
And To wrap up Sundance on the weekend with my co-host Stacey Domalski, and we're going to exit on an educational note with the documentary Ivory Tower and the director Andrew Rossi.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, just to start off, watching your film last night, a little anecdote occurred to me. From just one of the local interviews we did here on the radio station, when we had an advisor sort of coming in talking to our local news show about the importance of getting into what you can do to prepare to try to get into a good college, and our news anchor Leslie Thatcher was saying, well, you know, why is it that big a deal to get into a good college now? Because, I mean, you know, Bill Gates dropped out and Steve Jobs dropped out. And the guy said, yeah, but they dropped out from good colleges. And sort of, you know, what's happened to colleges in the last 30 years? And what do they have going for them besides prestige?
It's true. I think there's a cultural moment taking place in which people are challenging whether the sort of mythic ideal of going to college is really still something that's valid and something that should make people go into incredible amounts of student debt. So we see that tuition rates have risen since 1978 by over 1,000%. And student loan debt is now cumulatively over $1 trillion in this country. But as you referenced, people like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, they dropped out of Harvard and they now run these incredible companies that hire people who go to college. So in essence, if you're not sort of one of those extraordinary outlier type of geniuses, the idea that you can follow their lead is not really – doesn't totally make sense.
Well, and also back then, the college did not cost what it costs now when they dropped out of the college they went to. Reed College then and Reed College now, it's two different animals.
Completely. And that's something that we hear from a lot of the young people in the film who are millennials and identify as part of that generation and say that their parents and other older people don't empathize with them in the same way because they were able to go to state schools and pay almost nothing or any other private schools that were competitive at that time. But now those tuition rates have just skyrocketed. And also the employment market for them is really tough. Over 50% of students who graduate in 2012 are either unemployed or underemployed. So it's a really tough scene out there.
Yeah, in the Q&A on last night, I think after seeing the film, there was somebody in the audience who was still a little unclear. He was trying to put his finger on just what had gone wrong in the last 30 years because, well, when I went to college in the 70s, colleges then still, they liked to build big fancy buildings. And then, you know, kids had to get the hard truth that a degree in English Lit did not get you a big job market and things, those conditions back then. But I had a tuition that I could afford, that I could deal with.
Well, there are several factors that contribute to tuition rates skyrocketing. One of the central ones is that state funding for higher education has decreased to an alarming degree. And as a result, for example, we hear in the film Teresa Sullivan, the president of UVA, saying that for every $4 that she has lost from state funding, they've increased tuition by $1. And so now both in-state and out-of-state tuition at UVA is extremely high. But there's another sort of bigger kind of cost disease that is taking place in some schools. And it's basically a race for prestige. It's a race to build in order to stay at the top of rankings. And that's something that's very insidious and could be corrected.
Why did it happen in recent decades? Like I said, when I went to college, I'm sure my college too wanted to be compared to Harvard. So how come it got crazy?
I think what we see in the film is a transition from the idea of college as a public good to a private good. And if we see sort of historically how FDR and Lyndon Johnson and others believe that college could be part of this great society or a New Deal to allow everyone to have certain economic rights, that all really shifted in the 70s when governors, particularly Governor Reagan in California, started to say that sort of intellectual curiosity should not be something that is subsidized by the state. And so we saw in the 70s on into the 80s a shift in people thinking that, well, if you go to school, you know, you're going to make more money in the job market and it's a private good and you should pay for it. And so out of that sort of shift, the loan market came to allow people who didn't have the funds to go to school to afford it. But of course, we see how that loan market has now totally gotten out of control.
But, you know, Ronald Reagan hasn't been around for 25 years. Why is it the philosophy still here?
That's an excellent question. And right. and I think that that's...
Well, who perpetuates it maybe right. is what, you know, where's yeah. it coming from?
I don't know. I think our whole, the social fabric of this country right now is really in a moment of sort of reassessing how did we get to a place where there's a lot of inequality, financial, social, and I think college is unfortunately becoming one of those mechanisms in society that instead of sometimes creating social mobility, unfortunately, is creating class difference. Because if you graduate from college with over $50,000 in debt, your class position has been cemented as actually lower than those who were able because of their family's abilities or whatnot.
Right. And if you're coming out to become a teacher or, you know, a medical assistant or something like that, you're already deeper in the hole than you would be if you came out at ground zero.
Precisely.
Yeah. When did we have the shift that it seems like there was a shift that that at the very least one had to have a high school diploma or you couldn't, you know, make your way in society, and it seems like maybe now our attitude is at the very least you have to have a college diploma or you're hopelessly out of it.
I completely agree, Rick, and I think that's what people really feel is that the college degree is now the new high school degree, and the master's is the new college. And so there's been this sort of mission creep in the higher education sector to have people stay in school longer and I guess, spend more money.
Go deeper in debt.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
A lot of the film goes into different modes of what college might mean. The Deep Springs College in Death Valley with kids stacking hay and talking about Hegel, and the all black college and the internet universities, and I don't know if is there one of those alternatives that is kind of the right answer for you, or are you kind of leaving it up to us?
I think that it's really evolving. So we look at massive open online courses, which are known as MOOCs, and there are several companies that provide those, Udacity, Coursera, edX. Unfortunately, the data shows that some of those programs online are not so good for students who have remedial needs, who need more guidance. And so I think the film ultimately is a testament to the power of teaching and the power of one-on-one contact. But certainly providing classes online is a way to cut costs and to increase access. And so there's a lot of exciting ways in which that alternative can help.
It can't touch everybody, but it does fulfill a need.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting. I have a freshman in college. He goes to the University of Miami in Florida. He went pretty much close to a full ride because he's a jazz saxophone player, and he is majoring in jazz performance. And I've had people say to me when I tell them that, don't you think that's a little irresponsible of you to let him major in something that can't sustain a living? And I don't know what to say to that. One, he earned it, you know, because he's paid for it himself. But I think it's interesting that if you're not majoring now in business, law, pre-med, something, that it feels like the college degree is being wasted.
Well, I think, you know, that kind of personal journey takes place, you know, hundreds of thousands of times all across this country. People saying that they're going to take a risk, they're going to pursue something that they feel passionate about. And I think that that's still possible, even in the tough economy that we live in. The thing that makes it untenable is the debt. Mm-hmm. So if your son is able to afford it, or your family is able to do it, or he has grants and scholarships, then that's a salvation. And he, you know, he can take this path and pursue and maybe become the next great jazz saxophonist. Mm-hmm. We don't, as a society, want to foreclose that option from people.
Right, yeah. Right.
So, and the next chance is to explore all these answers and questions in the Ivory Tower is Monday. You're back at the Temple Theater, Andrew.
Yes.
You're going to get used to that place.
Yes.
And you're down in Salt Lake. But later on in the week, Thursday at the Prospector Square Theater. And you wrap up next Saturday at the Egyptian.
Yes.
So thank you very much for coming by.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we handle a very complex topic in 6 minutes.
I
know,
I wish we had more time.
We figured it all out, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. We solved world problems.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and I hope the conversation continues.
Thank you.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Lost and Found, traffic, weather, and local stories. Only in Park City, only on KPCW. This is KPCW Park City.
All right, and that concludes our programming for this morning covering the Sundance Film Festival. But stay with us later today from 1 to 4. We're going to be simulcasting KCRW out of L.A. while they're here at the Sundance Film Festival, and they're going to be doing more interviews. We're going to simulcast them from 1 to 4 p.m. And then tomorrow we'll be back with Leslie Thatcher and her co-host, and at 9 o'clock they're going to continue with the KPCW coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. We're coming up on 1 minute after 10 o'clock, 30 degrees outside the Sweet Alley Studios, and you are listening to KPCW Park City.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. In Thailand, at least 28 people are injured after an explosion shook an encampment of anti-government protesters in the capital, Bangkok. This after a grenade attack Friday killed one person and injured 35. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports.
The blast struck near Bangkok's Victory Monument, one of several key intersections that protesters have occupied in an attempt to shut down the city and force caretaker Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat to resign. The city is not shut down. Schools have been closed, but all but one are expected to reopen on Monday. The protests and sporadic violence have heightened fears that the military will intervene and stage a coup d'etat. A general election has been scheduled for February 2nd, but the opposition, composed mostly of royalists in the urban middle class, have little chance of winning and plan to boycott it. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
In Ukraine, tens of thousands of anti-government protesters took to the streets of Kiev today, despite sweeping new laws threatening punishment for public demonstrations. They've been demanding the resignation of President Viktor Yanukovych for nearly 2 months. Opposition politicians are calling on people to disregard the new laws that ban rallies. The Obama administration is welcoming yesterday's vote by Syria's main Western-backed opposition group to attend this week's peace conference in Geneva. The vote to participate came only after many Syrian National Coalition members walked out. The coalition is now determining the members of its delegation. The upcoming meeting will be the first direct talks between the Syrian government and their rivals in the nearly three-year conflict. Meanwhile, Syrian activist women are demanding a seat at the negotiating table. Lisa Schlein has that story from Geneva.
The Syrian women say they are most affected by conflict, so their voices must be heard. Speaking through an interpreter, Syrian activist Kefa Ali Deep says women must take part in all negotiations and decisions affecting their country.
We have to participate in the transitional government, and we have to take part in all the committees that will draft the constitution as well as the laws in the democratic transitional process.
The upcoming talks seek to find a political solution to Syria's civil war, which has killed more than 100,000 people. The women activists say they cannot remain silent in the face of these catastrophic events. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Iraqi officials say government forces backed by allied tribal militias are carrying out a major assault on al-Qaeda-linked militants in Ramadi, the provincial capital of Anbar province. The militants, along with other groups that oppose Iraq's Shiite-led government, also control the center of nearby Fallujah. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says his first priority is to eliminate terrorism. This is NPR. New Jersey Assemblyman John Wisniewski, head of the investigation into the George Washington Bridge lane closure scandal, says there's no evidence linking Governor Chris Christie to the alleged plot.
There's absolutely no document that connects the governor to this. His office is connected, not him. I've said that talking about impeachment is premature. There's no connection that he knew or that he directed it.
But Wisniewski says the governor should have been more aware. Arrests along the U.S.-Mexico border are up for the second straight year. NPR's Ted Robbins has details.
The total number of apprehensions along the southwest border for the last federal fiscal year was about 414,000. That's 16% higher than the year before. A person crossing the border can be apprehended more than once, so it's likely the actual number of individuals was lower. The Border Patrol says the increase came mostly from Central Americans trying to cross in Texas. The shortest route from Central America leads to Texas. This is the second straight year that Texas led border states in apprehensions. The government notes that while overall numbers are up, they're far below 2008 levels. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Tucson.
The U.S. military's plan to move its Marine Corps air base to a small town on the Japanese island of Okinawa could be facing a major setback. Voters in the town have elected a new mayor who vows to deny permits for the project. The current base is located in a more congested part of Okinawa, and it's given rise to local tensions over things like aircraft noise and base-related crime. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org.
All right, if you're heading to the slopes today, 113 runs open at PCMR with 47 of them groomed. Deer Valley has 57 of their 98 runs groomed. And Canyon's groomed 40 of their 155 open runs. The competitions at PCMR are completed, and we've got just a really beautiful day out ahead of us. If you are heading out to the slopes, highly recommend it. It is 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. This is KPCW.
On the show today, ideas about leadership, disruptors, the change agents, the mistakes they made, and the lessons they learned along the way. Which brings us to a volcano.
Eyja, Flæja, Jökull.
In Iceland.
Val.
With an unpronounceable name.
Eyja, Flæja, Jökull.
Eyja, Fetla, Jökull. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Nearly. And for 6 days in April 2010, the volcano's ash cloud grounded all air travel in Europe. Millions of people stuck on the ground, including General Stanley McChrystal, the top military commander in Afghanistan, and his staff. They were in Paris. And so was journalist Michael Hastings. He was writing a profile of McChrystal. And as Michael Hastings told NPR back then, he was only supposed to be there in Paris with the general for 2 days. But then...
Volcano in Iceland exploded. I ended up basically stranded with them. And instead of going back to Washington, which was my original plan, I followed them to Berlin and then later to Kabul.
So a few days turned into a month with General McChrystal and his staff. And during that month, the group, which was already tight-knit, probably got a little too comfortable around Hastings, who later published that profile in Rolling Stone. McChrystal was in Afghanistan at the time.
It emerged suddenly in the middle of the night. You know, we knew the guy was working on the story, but it was a complete surprise when it came out, the tone of it. I thought it would be completely positive, but it wasn't. It basically said that we were pushing the war in a direction that maybe wasn't right. And then it alleged discussions in my team about different people in U.S. leadership positions in a way that, you know, those kinds of comments should not be made.
I was in a room while General McChrystal prepared a speech to give that he was going to give in Paris. General McChrystal said, oh, what if I get a question about Vice President Biden? How should I respond? At that moment, they started making jokes about Vice President Biden. And that was on the record.
And that was really the least of it. Hastings' article, published with the headline, The Runaway General, included a lot of quotes we can't repeat on the radio. It was an embarrassment to the White House, and it made it look like the president wasn't on the same page with the man commanding his war. And so Stan McChrystal had a choice. He could fight the story or not.
Today I accepted General Stanley McChrystal's resignation as commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. I did so with considerable regret.
I mean, in some ways, was the only leadership decision or the best leadership decision you could have taken was to do what you did, to leave?
I think it was. Of course, I'll never know for sure. I would have liked it if the president had said, okay, I got it, go back out, continue to serve. But he didn't. So, you know, sometimes curveballs don't curve. And you just move on.
How long did it take you to recover from that?
I'll let you know when I'm completely recovered.
In some ways, what happened to Stan McChrystal was because of the way he led. Because for him, leadership is about connection and a shared sense of mission. And so that team around him, well, they were candid with each other. And McChrystal was candid with them. It was like a band of brothers. And when McChrystal spoke on the TED stage, about a year after all this happened, by the way, he explained that he learned this kind of leadership from watching the leaders who came before him.
I was raised with traditional stories of leadership, Robert E. Lee, John Buford at Gettysburg. And I also was raised with personal examples of leadership. This was my father in Vietnam. And I was raised to believe that soldiers were strong and wise and brave and faithful. They didn't lie, cheat, steal, or abandon their comrades. And I still believe real leaders are like that. But in my first 25 years of career, I had a bunch of different experiences. One of my first battalion commanders, I worked in his battalion for 18 months, and the only conversation he ever had with Lieutenant McChrystal was at mile 18 of a 25-mile road march, and he chewed my ass for about 40 seconds. And I'm not sure that was real interaction. But then a couple years later, when I was a company commander, I went out to the National Training Center, and we did an operation, and my company did a dawn attack, you know, the classic dawn attack. You prepare all night, move to the line of departure, and I had an armored organization at that point. We move forward, and we get wiped out. I mean, wiped out immediately. The enemy didn't break a sweat doing it. And after the battle, they bring this mobile theater and they do what they call an after-action review to teach you what you've done wrong, sort of leadership by humiliation. They put a big screen up and they take you through everything, and then you didn't do this and you did do this, etc. I walked out feeling as low as a snake's belly in a wagon rut. And I saw my battalion commander because I had let him down. And I went up to apologize to him and he said, Stanley, I thought you did great. And in one sentence, he lifted me, put me back on my feet, and taught me that leaders can let you fail and yet not let you be a failure.
And at that moment when he sensed he either could have put the knife in and really twisted it, he did the exact opposite. And just that gesture on his part was incredibly binding. I'll be bound to him forever.
I mean, it sounds like that moment really changed you? I mean, do you live by his example as a leader?
We try to every day. And, of course, the thing about leadership is you fail every day. You know, when you start your career as a leader, one of the first things you want to do is be demanding. You want to have high standards, and you want to be very demanding. And you want to say that things are black or they are white. And if you are not on the right side of that, then you failed. But you can't forget you're working with people. And long term, if you're really trying to get the most out of people, you got to build people up, not tear them down. And I think that's something that I learned about not just myself, but other people, that you're really trying to get inside someone's heart and soul and bind them to what it is you together are trying to accomplish.
Did you ever sort of lie in bed at night and think, am I doing this right? Am I making the right decisions?
Every day. I'm sure there are leaders who see this perfect vision and they guide their organization in that direction, but that wasn't me. I was most bolstered or most reinforced by the understanding that where we were, the status quo was failing. And because it was failing, I knew we had to change. But then instead of trying to provide an exact path ahead from the wisdom of the great commander, what I did was I tried to inform and engage the command and say, we have to move. We have to move in this general direction. Help me figure it out. And that worked very well because as people did that, we refined the direction we were going and it constantly shifted. And it made more people the agents of change.
You probably think that the force that I led was all steely-eyed commandos with big knuckle fists carrying exotic weapons. In reality, much of the force I led looked exactly like you. It was men, women, young, old, not just from military, from different organizations, many of them detailed to us just on a handshake. And so instead of giving orders, you're now building consensus and you're building a sense of shared purpose. Probably the biggest change was understanding that the generational difference, the